Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. Our guest this afternoon is James C. Capretta, a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, as well as a former associate director at the White House Office of Management and Budget from 2001 to 2004, where he had responsibility for federal health care, social security, education, and welfare programs. James, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul. I'm glad to be with you again.
James, you've had a couple of excellent articles recently. Most recently, your article co-authored with Yuval Levin, Why Obamacare is Still No Sure Thing, in the Wall Street Journal on November 18th. And then another very interesting piece in the Health Affairs blog entitled Health Policy After the Election. And I wanted to talk to you about that exact question, where health policy is going after the election and after some changes at the Senate level, some changes in the House, and then a number of changes at the level of the federal governors. There are now 30 Republican governors. So we now know who's going to be president for the next 4 years, and I guess the repeal of the Affordable Care Act is off the table at least until 2016. But is full implementation of the law a fait accompli at this point? I think certainly that's what the president and defenders of the law would like us to think, but is that really true?
That's a very good question and a great launching point, I think. I think you're right to start this by noting that the president got reelected, and so for those of us that have opposed the law and wanted to move in a different direction in health care, we do have to face the reality. You have a president in the Oval Office who's not going to repeal the health care law. So it's going to remain on the books, and that's going to have significant implications. The question is what happens moving forward, and the law was written with a high degree of state implementation dependence, so to speak. In other words, the law is written assuming that the states will be a big part of implementing its key provisions, namely both a Medicaid expansion for everyone up to 133% of the poverty line, as well as what are called the exchanges. Those are the mechanisms by which people who aren't in employer-based health insurance but are above Medicaid eligibility in terms of their incomes, where they would get their health insurance. And if they're below 400% of the poverty line, they would get subsidies from the federal government. So these exchanges are anticipated to be set up in every state in the country, but the states have an option explicitly written into the law whether they are going to take that option up or leave that administrative function to the federal government. Moreover, the Supreme Court decision that came down in June indicated that the states do not have to do the Medicaid expansion. It's an option at the state level. Because of the financial requirements in the states, the Supreme Court ruled that it would be coercive for the federal government to make every state do it. So the states have two big choices ahead of them, whether to do the Medicaid expansion and the exchanges, and their decisions can have pretty significant implications for the operation of the law. I think the one broad point I want to make here is that because we have 30 Republican governors, right, which is 60% of the country, the Republican governors have a fair amount of leverage in making these choices, that the administration surely wants these governors to actually fulsomely implement the law. It would be a lot easier for the administration if the governors were partners in moving forward. So to the extent that the governors say, look, the law is deficient in its current structure, and we're going to say no as it's currently constituted, I think they gain a fair amount of leverage, frankly, in this process. It's not at all clear what's going to happen going forward, but to the extent that there ever is a moment to amend or change the law, I believe that these Republican governors will be the ones who have the most ability to make some change.
Yeah, I think those are two terrific points. And let me add another one that you and you will address, not in too much depth, but at least in passing in your Wall Street Journal article, and that is the issue of how far along the state exchanges, or the federal exchange for that matter, is in actual implementation. The Obama administration actually put off literally dozens of regulations that are required under the Affordable Care Act for the operation of both the small group and individual insurance markets, both inside and outside the exchanges. So even basic questions about how the actuarial value rules are going to work, how the rate bands are going to work under the law, even what qualifies as insurance for the purposes of getting onto the exchanges in terms of essential health benefits, all of those regulations, I think a number of them just dropped today. We're expecting a slew of them to come forward because the president, very smartly, I think, didn't want any of these micro bombs to drop before the election that would impose new costs on insurance markets and that people would be talking about right before the election. But we're facing an enrollment deadline for the exchanges of October 13th. A number of states have not, of course, set up their exchanges. A number of states have said that they won't. Avalir Health has said, I think that at most we're going to see 20 states trying to set up either pure state exchanges or federal slash state called federally facilitated exchanges. So I see a kind of a moving train wreck on the exchange front right now, where we're going to have a number of confusing regulations come down in short order. Even if states wanted to try and get their exchanges up and running by October for enrollment for January 2014, I don't see that happening. And then it doesn't seem like the federal exchange is any much better shape at this point, at least what I've been hearing. So we could have a situation where implementation for better, or at least from the perspective of someone who likes the ASA, is going to be delayed. And that may play very much into the situation that you just articulated, which is governors, if they have a single voice or at least can come agree on a common strategy, can press for real reforms. What do you think about that?
I very much agree with you, Paul. I agree very much that even those states that want to move forward with the exchanges are going to have a very hard time meeting that October deadline. Moreover, there's already been, you know, by my count, about 19 states that are hard no's. They're not going to build the exchanges. And there's probably another 5 or 6 that are very close to being hard no's as well. So you could have at least half the country saying they're not going to build the exchanges, at which point the federal government has got this task of building an exchange in every state that says no all by next October. The House has not appropriated any funding for them to do that, so they would have to raid the rest of their budget to try to scrounge up the resources to make that happen. I think it's going to be a big problem for the administration. Now, that's not to say that they won't get something done. I mean, you know, it's a matter of degree and competence, right? So they'll have a shell, undoubtedly, in every state and say, well, we do have something there, and they'll try to get it going. But it'll be, I don't think, very, very properly structured at all. And, you know, it'll lead to a lot of questions. Now, having said all that, I do believe that what's really at play here is that there's a big fiscal crisis brewing as well. And the president is going to want to have a negotiation with the Congress, especially the House Republicans, about getting the federal budget under control going forward. And it's really during those kinds of negotiations that if there's any chance for some bipartisanship on health care, that's the moment when governors and the House Republicans can press for some meaningful change, as you alluded to. I think, and there's some things I think, you know, they should ask for as part of that negotiation.
Could you just for a moment talk about the two opportunities that we're going to have, or at least that Congress will have, to potentially, you know, open the hood and go at the engine of this thing? In terms of, I think the two of them are going to be the fiscal cliff negotiations, which have to do with the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and a number of other provisions that are going to hit as of January 1, and then any broader debt and deficit negotiations that are going to occur sometime after that. I don't know. My sense is that they're not going to try and wrap both of them together in one enormous package in a lame duck Congress, but maybe you've got a better sense of that than I do.
Well, it's a fluid situation, but you're right. The immediate thing is that both parties have an interest in avoiding what's known as the fiscal cliff. That's the tax hikes and spending cuts that are all scheduled to occur shortly after January 1. They are expected to be of such magnitude and such immediacy that the economy might get tipped back into a recession and unemployment would rise again. So both parties fear driving off the fiscal cliff, so to speak. And as a result, there's negotiations underway about how to avoid that. The president's insisting on some tax increase on the upper-income households before any deal to avert the fiscal cliff can be put together. So they're in the middle of talking about that. Beyond that, you're exactly right. It's also the case that both parties, especially in 2013, are going to have a need to address the absolute crisis that's brewing in terms of the overall finances of the federal government. We're projected to have trillion-dollar deficits using current policies, you know, pretty much as far as the eye can see, which would be a disaster economically. The president has a strong interest, and I think even the Congress does too, doing something in 2013 to narrow that gap. Both of these negotiations are going to require passage through a House of Representatives that is controlled by Republicans. So there's a chance there that Republicans can ask for some changes in the health care law, even changes that the president finds undesirable from his perspective. And I think that's really where some of these ideas about what the state role ought to be, scaling back the cost of the program, much more flexibility at the state level, more market-oriented approaches in terms of the entitlement programs, Medicare and Medicaid, all of that could be put on the table for discussion.
And is there an appetite for that kind of big thinking? Do you see an opening there? I mean, if the House or you know, conservatives and some moderates said, well, what we'd like to do is have a discussion about the subsidies on the exchanges, up to 400% of FPL or $90,000 for a family of four seems a little ridiculous. Let's talk about going down to 200 or 250. Let's talk about the Medicaid expansion. Let's talk about block renting. We'll put all these things on the table and some mix of revenues. I mean, that would seem to be, you know, almost a perfect situation in terms of trying to have a rational conversation about the deficit and the debt and giving both parties something to declare victory on. Is that politically realistic?
You know, I it's hard to know what's realistic right now. We're just so close to just, you know, we're only 2 weeks out from the election. So everybody's still digesting everything. But look, they're saying that they want to put together a deal that includes tax and entitlement reform that brings down medium and long-term deficits very substantially through a combination of higher revenue through tax reform and lower spending through entitlement reform. That means everything's on the table. I mean, to do entitlement reform the right way, you got to raise exactly the kinds of questions you put on the table. You know, the Obama administration has a great interest in having this uniform national expansion in the Medicaid program. In fact, their entire program is really built on the notion that you're going to cover, you know, 15 million more people in Medicaid. You know, most Republican governors are saying that's, you know, just not a good way to go because we're going to be putting a lot of people into a program that we already know is failing and not working well for the current enrollees. Why would we do that? Let's fix it first and then expand it. You know, if you're a Republican governor, why wouldn't you say to the administration, look, as part of this fiscal negotiation, we need to move in the direction of a block grant or at least a per capita amount for all of our citizens that are in the what I would have called the acute care side of Medicaid, the non-disabled, non-elderly part, and give the states the flexibility to run that program entirely at their discretion. They don't have to go into a government-managed Medicaid program. They can go into, for instance, the same private insurance options that are available to the working-age population in the state. That would be a big reform that the Republican governors could push. It would save money, and it may be something that the administration actually would take a look at, because they do want to get this Medicaid expansion pushed through.
I hope you're right. I think I'd be especially interested in any kind of discussion that went at the tax treatment of health insurance and perhaps allowed states to wrap around Medicaid funding around a tax credit, a uniform tax credit. And allowed those people to go right into the market, which at the same time, if you went back and capped the deduction, I believe would help slow healthcare inflation and drive more choice and competition in the market. So that would be a big reform. So I get the sense from you, you know, just to wrap up, is that, you know, you see, you know, if we're going to have a real frank discussion of taxes, entitlements, and spending, you have to put the Obamacare, Affordable Care Act implementation on the table. And I think you've also heard at least some concerns on the left as well about, for instance, how similarly situated people are treated both in terms of being on the exchange or getting employer-provided insurance. David Gamage had a great law review article not too long ago and an article in the Wall Street Journal where he pointed out that this is going to have a lot of unintended effects, bad unintended effects on low-income Americans in terms of reducing their disincentives to opt for higher-paying jobs, to get married, going to lead to a lot of people getting dropped out of coverage they have now because the subsidies are so much more generous on the exchanges, at least up to a certain point, 200% of 250% of FPL. So it does seem like there's at least some acknowledgement on the left, especially if I can add one more thought on adverse selection in terms of, you know, we've got guaranteed issue, but still no way to get people, since the penalty is so small, to actually sign up for coverage. Maybe there's some appetite on the left for going at some of these problems if they're framed the right way.
Well, I hope so. You know, I wouldn't bet the ranch on it, of course, because they are pretty wedded. Most of them are pretty wedded to the law as written, and they don't want to touch it because they're fearful that, you know, it'll get scaled back to some extent, and I think it would. But, you know, that may be the price they have to pay to, you know, have a launch in 2014 or 2015 or whenever it gets rolling that, you know, runs much more smoothly than it looks like it will at the current moment. Because you're going to have a patchwork, as things stand, with, you know, half the governors at least saying no to the exchanges and the Medicaid expansion, you're going to have a very serious, you know, patchwork system that won't be nearly what the president has promised.
Well, that's a terrific point to end on. James Capretta, again, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Terrific articles. I recommend them highly. Why Obamacare is Still No Sure Thing from the Wall Street Journal, and his other article, Healthcare Policy After the Election, on the Health Affairs blog. James, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.